You're listening to Ian Stone's Comedy Breakfast, the podcast edition. I'm here on Love Sport Radio every weekday morning at 6:30. This morning I was joined by the former Watford and England legend, Luther Blissett. Morning, Luther.
Good morning, sir. How
Good
are
morning.
You?
I'm fine. Thank you very, very
Good
much.
Good man.
Somebody told me that Bobby Robson kept getting your name wrong once. I was talking.
Only one person's told you that. I'm very, very surprised.
Somebody told me the other day.
Yeah, did. Who were you talking? Was it let me think, Graham Roberts?
I can't remember. Somebody said to me, he called him Bluther. He kept calling him Bluther.
And all the boys that are in the team, they all know it. And they occasionally run a bump in him. That's the first thing they
Bluther.
Say to me.
Yeah. How fantastic. But you didn't want to correct him because he didn't seem...
Well, the thing is, it was one of those. I was not the only one. He called everybody by the wrong name. Now, he only remembered, really, there was... Kevin Keegan, because let's face it, you know, Kev.
Yeah.
Kevin, he knew Kevin Keegan. Schultz and, or Clem or a couple of others.
And that was it.
And really the rest of us, you know, we just sat to put up with whatever you were called.
Right. I mean, there was also somebody told me a story about how we got Kenny Sansom and Derek Statham mixed up one time.
Well, understandable as well when you look at them both together.
Yeah. We were blessed with left backs when we were back then. It was just mentioned to me. Let's talk about the cricket. England lost to Australia. This is their third loss in the World Cup. They lost to Pakistan, who they spanked in a one-day series before the World Cup started. They suddenly get the World Cup and they lose. Most shockingly, they lost to Sri Lanka.
Ridiculous.
And then yesterday was so disappointing.
Yeah, the Aussies were just better.
They were.
The Australians were just a better team on the day. No doubt about it, they were better and they more than deserved their victory. But England, for me, just... It's something, and I think I probably said it once or twice, when it comes to it in games, you think, are they winners? Are they serial winners? Are they a team that will go on and just dominate for a period of time? When you look at what the Australians do it regularly, you look at what the West Indies did in that period when they just dominated the game. You're wanting to see England go and do that and dominate, not just for 1-2, but 3, 4, 5, 6 years or so and make themselves, you know, to be that great team that we all want them to be.
You do want them to do that. But I must admit, before this World Cup started, I thought they are in good nick.
And even, they did. And when the little trip to, when they went to Jamaica and the Caribbean, that sort of made you think for a little bit when now those are going to think they can't afford to do this when the World Cup comes around. And here they are. They're now falling back into doing that at times. In games, they should go out and, you know, just get rid of the opposition, win the game, and they can put their feet up and relax for the next one.
But I wasn't very impressed with the Pakistan game. But the fielding was bad in the Pakistan game.
Yeah, that was terrible.
They dropped Hafiz, 70 more runs. That tells you, I think fielding says a lot about what a team is like.
Yeah.
You know, it's those... That mentality.
That's really how you can win the game. Because if the opposition know that you're not going to give them anything when you're in the field, it makes it tough on them because they know they have to then score all the runs that they're going to win the game by.
Well, watching Australia yesterday in the field, and they were so on it.
Yeah.
They were so on it. And you think, why aren't we in that? What is going on? Now, Owen Morgan has talked about passivity. They're too passive. And you think... Yeah, but why are they too passive? They're in the middle of a World Cup. Now, it doesn't, by the way, it doesn't mean all is lost.
No.
Two games. They've got New Zealand and India. They win one of them. They pretty much
should be there. But it should not come to this point now. It shouldn't happen.
With games like this, right, with team games in tournaments, isn't it about momentum? Isn't it? I mean, they've lost two games in a row now, Sri Lanka and Australia. If they limp over the line into the semi-final, do you think that New Zealand and India and Australia would fear them?
What they would do, they would know if the England that is at the top of its game turns up, then they would have a job on their hands to beat them. They will be completely aware of that.
But they know that they can be got at.
But yes, and that is the big thing for me because it is all about that mentality when you're going up against teams that are of your equal or close to your equal or better than you, how you then go and cope with that. And you have to go in with the mental, you know, everything mental about that game has got to be, we are going to win this game because of this, this, and this. And the first thing is the way you prepare for the game. And you have to be mentally go through all these things. And it's about you being successful every time
they
in everything that you do.
They must
and
know
it's everything.
This.
They should know that. But you don't get that feeling when they walk out onto the pitch that they have got that look in their eyes and say, today, I mean, you're playing Australia for crying out loud. If you know there's one game, regardless of what state they're in, it doesn't matter, because you play Australia, and Australia could be in a woeful state. They're going to still give you a game. They're going to make life hard for you, you know, whichever way, apart from last year. You know, but so many things had happened to them leading into that.
I think you can discount that, whereas this year, this is the real Australia again. This is the team. I mean, I thought they'd get more than 200 and whatever it was, 85. I must admit, when they were batting away and there were 100 and something for...
England did well to you know, to... get the keep the mantle. Was it 68? Was it 268?
285. I believe it was.
You know what they get. So England did well to keep them below 300, no doubt about it. But you know, then to go and lose it themselves by 60 in 44 point. What was it? Whatever number of overs. It was disappointing. It's disappointing that we just fall apart. One, we lose a wicket, then we lose another and lose another. You know, it's.
How big a loss is Roy?
Roy.
They've really missed him, haven't they?
He is a big loss. If he's a big scorer, then you know what happens in teams, though? Somebody else steps up. Somebody steps into that position. Yeah, they may not be getting the hundreds or whatever that he was getting, but they still get strong scores. And our problem, we don't have enough batsmen that are getting between somewhere between 50 and 100. We don't do that.
Might have got quite a few runs at the start of the innings.
Yeah, but that,
Alex Hales.
Yeah, but the problem is he discounted himself from that by his conduct. And quite rightly so.
Yeah.
And, you know, people can go back and keep throwing that one about, but that is a pointless one to say, because he has really written himself out of it because of his behaviour. And you cannot condone somebody that does this and doesn't look at the ramifications of what he's doing. He's doing something which, for one thing, is illegal in the first place. And he's doing it while being part of the national team. You can't tolerate that.
I mean, look, in the end, it would have been great to have a fit and firing and non-drug-taking Alex Hales in
Absolutely.
The team. But as it turns out...
But that is not the case.
We couldn't have him, so we've got the players we've got. But everyone was talking about them as favourites before the tournament.
Yeah, now, and again, I think they were believing that they were favourites, you know, quite rightly so.
But that's okay to believe you're favourites, but you've got to start producing...
You've got to deliver. The way you show that is when you get onto that field, you make life so difficult for the opposition that they're the ones that crack first.
And that's what it felt like. That's what it felt like Australia were doing to us yesterday. Yeah. That is what it felt like. And I just thought, I don't understand what's happened to the mentality of this team. Anyway, no doubt we will be coming back to that. We're going to be talking, I mean, in fact, in a big debate this morning at about 8:15, something like that, we're going to be having a debate about team mentality.
Yeah.
Something you would know a lot about, and we'll discuss whether England's mentality at this World Cup has been wrong, certainly in some games. The other big story this morning, Frank Lampard. Well, I've got to get this right the right way around. Derby have given permission for Frank Lampard to talk to Chelsea, basically, or for Chelsea to talk to Frank Lampard. It looks very much like Frank Lampard.
It looks nailed on, doesn't it?
Chelsea manager. Yeah, assuming they can agree terms, and there's no reason why not. They are also, by the way, appealing the arbitration, the sport arbitration committee or something, about the two transfer window ban that they've got. Whatever happens, if Frank Lampard and Jody Morris go to Chelsea, that has got to be a good move for Chelsea, is it not?
Yes, we go back to a little bit of what's been going on at Manchester United when they spoke to the likes of Rio Ferdinand and a number of other players about the technical, what is the technical director's thing at the club. If you can get people involved, especially if you're trying to rebuild something, is to get people that understand what the club stood for, what it stands for, what it means to the people that pay good money week in, week out to travel up and down the country to watch you play.
Who knows what you're building, essentially.
It is. And, you know, because what you want to do is say, this is the base where we can then get some of these top players in from. Chelsea are in a position where they can't buy anyone.
No.
So if you can't buy anyone, and they already have a multitude of very young and good talent at their disposal for such a long time, they have to start playing them. And Frank could be the man that can just help them to start that building process properly.
I mean, it's not just Frank Lampard. We should point out, if Frank Lampard goes to Chelsea, Jody Morris is coming with him. Jody Morris, of course, who has been the head of youth development there.
What, it's 18 months ago, that's where he was?
And he knows, so he would know all the loan players, he would know all the young players, he would know their strengths and weaknesses. I mean, it seems to me like Jody Morris is just as, or even more important in this setup as Frank Lampard.
Well, quite often the coaches are. I mean, you look at United under Sir Alex Ferguson. Sir Alex Ferguson did a great job, but the people that he brought in as his coach,
Mike Phelan, for example,
massive impact that they had on the way that United went about it, because they're the ones that have that everyday contact and working with the players.
And you would expect Frank Lampard to be bright enough to know that if Jody Morris says something, he's not saying it for no reason. They obviously have a decent relationship. Yeah. We took him to Derby. They did pretty well. Mm. It's not just about Jody Morris as well, by the way. Peter Cech's already there, just signed up.
Yes.
Didier Drogba is rumoured to be joining the coaching staff. Well, what forward would not like to be coached?
If that doesn't help them going forward, then they, you know, there's a problem.
And Gianfranco Zola, Kudacini and Hilario are already there. So that sort of stuff, those players who've been at the setup a long time, know the feel of the club, the general philosophy, if you like, of a club, that can only help.
It can only help because what it does, they instill in all the players, this is why Chelsea have been so successful, because of this. Yes, we've got talented players in here and there, but what we have this love for the club. This love for the shirt, for playing for these people, you know, coming to this stadium, making sure that nobody comes here and ever believe they're going to get a result. And that is what you're instilling people. And you do that only by having people that have actually been there in the past. I mean, look how long it's taken Jurgen Klopp to get that sort of mentality back into back into Liverpool.
This is the question, you see, because yes, Jurgen Klopp had no connection with Liverpool, but he obviously gets it. He obviously gets the whole mentality of the club, the city. He understands the Scouse mentality, right?
He does.
He really, really does. Mm. So you don't have to have a prior connection with the club in order to get it.
Yeah, but I think the difference with Jurgen Klopp with all of this, that is the way he manages. He manages almost on that personal level with all of the players. All the players buys into what he wants to do and the way he wants to do it. And by the players buying into that, they also buy into what the club is all about.
Yeah, you know what? I agree with all that, but it seems to me that with Jurgen Klopp, he understands the emotional connection that the club has with the city and with the people.
There are very few head coaches that come in and have that understanding. Guardiola comes in, and what he did, yes, he understands what the club all stood for, but he knew that he had to do more because he already had a very good squad of players anyway. So he brought in and said, now, with already what we have, if you can then do this, because I've proven that this is what I've done over a period of time in every club I've been to, you'll be successful.
Yeah, I mean, City is a different matter again. But with Chelsea, I do see that Frank Lampard could be successful. I think the most important thing is if that transfer ban is upheld, he is going to have to dip into the youth team and have the younger players and the loan players. And that's where Jody Morris will come in very, very handy. Personally, if I was a Chelsea fan, I'd be excited by this development. I'm looking at Paris, who is our producer.
And a little bit apprehensive, I think.
Which
has got to come because, yes, he's had a good year, but we must not forget, with all the resources that he had at his disposal, they didn't make it to the Premier League. We must never forget that.
Close.
That is something. Yeah, close. But in the Premier League, but what it is, when it comes to promotion, close is nowhere. You're no different to all the other teams that didn't make it really at the end of it.
I think, I sort of understand that. If I'm a Derby fan, though, I'm looking at their season and going, we had a good year. We did well in the Cup.
Yeah.
We got to the playoff final. You know.
But that's Derby that have been over the past 5 or 6 years been really one or two steps away from being in that position anyway.
Yeah.
And they managed to do it with a lot of young, talented players from other clubs they brought in and it worked. But I think... Yes, I'm hoping that he does well because he's an English coach now, manager that is in there, and you want to see as many homegrown coaches in the Premier League as possible because we don't have enough.
And it's nice to see, by the way, an English manager in the top six.
Oh.
Because that doesn't happen very, very often. I think Harry Redknapp might have been the last one. Related. It's only one family of English managers who can manage in the top six. Anyway, Louise apparently has taken over at Arsenal in a couple of years. They're not together anymore, are they? Actually, no, they're not. Anyway.
This is Love Sport.
Frank Lampard is within touching distance of a dream move back to Stamford Bridge as manager of Chelsea. It marks a change of approach from owner Roman Abramovich, but how successful will he be? Joining us now is the ex-Chelsea defender, Michael Dubry. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Now, it is a change of approach. After Maurizio Sarri, there wasn't really the connection with the fans. Frank Lampard's not going to have a problem with that, is he?
No. I think it's... he's got a great connection. They love him. You know, he's virtually God up there. So it'll be a good one from the point of view where so many unhappy fans with Sarri ball last year.
Yeah, and also he's going to bring Jody Morris with him. I've been saying all morning, it feels like almost just as important as appointment to have Jody there with the fact that he knows the youth setup and he knows the club.
Yeah, listen, I think he's important to Lamps and what he done last year at Derby. Lamps has got his backroom staff and feels comfortable. And especially Jody, you know, he's a tremendous run as youth team set up, very successful. He knows all of the kids, they know him. You know, if they do get the upgrade into the first team set up, they'll be very comfortable with having, you know, a coach that they know and can welcome into that set up.
Yeah, I mean... I was just thinking, the appointment of Lampard, if they go ahead and do this, and it looks as if it's going to happen, for obviously having an English manager, great,
yeah,
in one of the top six clubs, brilliant with that, but things don't go well the first few games, and we all know this is always possible, whether it's luck or whatever. What would that really? What position would that put him in, moving forward? And plus four, you know, he's a legend at that club as well.
Yeah, how can they sack a legend?
You know,
I think that it's a great appointment for them for the very same reason, because they've all shown patience. You saw, you know, up in Manchester with Ollie, like, they're patient with him. It ain't going well. They realise what's happening. They realise that, you know, we've got to work with what we've got. I think first six games don't go well. You know, they're going to be like, Chelsea have always done that, even with the homegrown, you know, is having a bad game. They're patient, they realise. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah, listen, if it's like they're coming near the back end of the season, they're relegation, they'll be the first to say, look, it's too big a job, we need a change. I don't think they're switching him like, you're not a legend anymore. But I just feel that they're saying, you know, we need a change. It may be too big too soon. But at the first six games, they'll be patient with him, they'll be cheering, they'll be seeing how it goes, and they realise it's a growing thing. They're growing together,
yeah,
a change of direction. So I don't think I think the club is smart if they do appoint him, saying they have that patience.
Well, I suppose the thing is, Michael, you think about Sarri, there were periods during last season when they could have sacked him and they didn't. And it shows maybe Roman Abramovich is not quite as, you know, happy to wield the axe just as quickly. What about his lack of experience, though? I mean, he's coming up against coaches like Klopp, like Guardiola, like Pochettino, who have really, you know, taken their teams to a different level, particularly Guardiola and Klopp. Frank, that's a big step up for him, a year in.
Yeah, he's got his ideas of football. He's got to implement them. He's got to, you know, try and put his coaching brains against some of the best coaches in the world. Do it now, you know, he's not going to maybe get that in the Championship. He's going to get it, you know, this is where he's going to get it at. He's had a season. He's ready to put his ideas there. He's got his squad. He knows what he's doing. I think just go for it. And he's got to get experience now. I think it's a chance as well to implement something that Liverpool, Man City done. They've got a structure, an in-house structure, and they can build from that. And I think with Lamps there, they can think, you know, a few years, we can start building. You know, once that transfer ban comes off, we can build even more so, get some big marquee names, and we've already got the infrastructure in place.
And what about this thing about bringing ex-players back, legends really, if you like, as coaches or technical advisors, people like Petr Cech, Claude Makélélé, Didier Drogba. There's talk about Drogba as well. These things have got to help, haven't they?
Yeah, I think it helps. I mean, there's no guarantee of success. Ultimately, people want someone to be successful, so bringing a legend back doesn't guarantee success. If it helps with how it is they know to set up, then brilliant. But ultimately, they're bringing these people back to help with success. They know the part of the most successful part of the club's history, and I think that's the idea behind it. But if it doesn't work, then it's a flop, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, Michael, on that, you know, the value of having players that have been through and have won things and understand the club. From your perspective, can you give listeners out there an idea of what that would bring, what that brings, you know, bringing in new players in on top of that with that experience and that knowledge already there?
Yeah, I think it just puts a culture in place. Everyone, you know, top businesses, top clubs, there's a culture, you know, there's a culture of winning. This is how we do stuff. It's a tradition. This is how we follow. This is the blueprint. This is what we do in a successful club. So everyone walks in the door, they know. It's not like everyone's doing their own thing. This is what we do. In this club, we do this, we do that. And I think that's what Chelsea want to get back to. There's a stage where Cech, Terry, Lampard, Drogba, everyone that walked in the door at Chelsea at that time knew this is how we operate. This is our ethos. And I think the club are trying to get back to that. Let's have an identity. The last few years, they've gone away from having an identity. It's just been everyone comes in the door,
yeah. They
play how they play. But now I think Chelsea want to get back to saying, look, this is our identity. We're strong through the middle. We have a core. And this is what we do. And Lamps now has to implement. This is the ethos of Chelsea Football Club under the Lampard regime if he gets the job.
And one more question before I let you go, Michael. I mean, Luther touched on it just before about having an English manager at a top six club. We were saying the last one was Harry Redknapp, who, by the way, is a member of the same family. We're saying there's only one family who can manage top six teams with English managers. But it is good to have an English guy managing a top six club, is it not?
Yeah, I think it's brilliant that, you know, English manager, you know, setting a trend, and hopefully it opens the doors for more. But, you know, again, he has to be successful, yep. He has to do well. Otherwise, it just becomes another statistic of maybe. I mean, so hopefully he does well and just opens a few more doors. But he's a young manager, great ideas, and hopefully, you know, he goes on to take the club to be a successful era.
Thanks, Michael. Nice to speak to you.
No problem.
See you soon, Michael Dubry there, ex-Chelsea and Leeds defender.
He took no prisoners, mate, I tell you.
Yeah, quite.
Played against him, yeah.
You played against him?
Yeah, played against him, yeah, in my later years.
Knew he was there.
Oh, yeah. Because them days, they still could tackle from behind.
They could go straight through you, couldn't they, really?
And, you know, they let you know early on they were there.
Yeah, okay. And yes, there's no missing him, was there? He's a big
no,
fella. But
that.
Yeah, in terms of this English manager being in charge, I think, listen, I don't want Chelsea to be successful because that means that Arsenal won't be successful. But I would like Frank Lampard to do well.
Yes, we all want Frank Lampard to do well. For the simple reason, it's a British manager. And we want to see more British players and more British managers and coaches in the Premier League, because that's what, you know, that tells you that we're in a good place with our football, if that is what's going on.
Yeah.
So it just reflects that very well. So, you know, all the power to him.
We'll see what happens when he gets the job in the next few days. Paris has come in with some other back page stories.
I have a story about Luis Suarez, who continues to make
this.
The news.
Go on.
Luis Suarez appealed for a handball in the game against Chile, appealing for a penalty, kind of really, you know, kind of going at the referee, except the person that handled the ball in the box was the Chilean goalkeeper.
Yeah.
So he hits the shot, the keeper uses his hand to block it, goes out for a corner, turns towards the referee, waves frantically, and the referee's probably just going, it's a corner, is that what you're appealing for? No, he's appealed for a handball. Not only does he do that, there is then a pitch invader who runs onto the pitch, running around. The Chilean player decides to take matters into his own hands and trips the guy up.
Yeah.
Luis Suarez sees this and runs towards the referee, asking for the guy to be booked or potentially being sent off.
I'm assuming he's talking about the Chilean player, asking for the Chilean player to be booked rather than the pitch invader.
Yeah, I don't think...
I mean, who knows?
I don't think the referee can book a pitch invader. Anyway, that's a different story. But the point is, you know, the article in the Times kind of going, you know, Suarez continues to do this. He continues to be a pantomime villain of sorts, but he kind of seems to believe that this is how he gains his advantage.
Listen. It worked. Listen, look, I'm assuming, Luther, that you would bite your hand off to play with Luis Suarez. Bite your hand off might be the wrong phrase to use when it comes to Luis Suarez.
He would probably bite your hand off.
But, well, yeah, but what a player.
No.
What? And the way he plays at Barcelona, because obviously he was the man at Liverpool,
yeah.
and if he had a chance of a shot, he would take one. Whereas with Messi, he knows
he knows that he is a close second to Messi, and yeah. that's how he sees it. And, but he knows Messi is there and he's there.
But, yeah. you know, whatever you think, however objectionable you might think of him as a character, the biting and the cheating and all the rest of it, when it comes to what he's doing at Barcelona, he's an absolutely unbelievable footballer.
Yeah.
And the selflessness, I know it's mad to say it when we're talking about Luis Suarez, but the way that he serves the master, Messi,
yeah.
is really something to behold. And yeah, what a player to have doing stuff for you.
Yeah, but more to the point of that, we were talking about mentality and that sort of thing. And it comes across in some various different ways with people. And his way is, we do find it quite horrible unless he's in your team.
Yeah.
The way he is, because every decision he wants it. And he protests as if his life depends on it.
Oh, listen, he's playing for Liverpool. He's dirtying, cheating South American yeah. forward. If he's playing for us, he's our wily, brilliant South American yeah. centre forward. Mm. And it's just how it goes.
Yes.
And, you know, but there are plenty of players like that. Plenty of players in the same yeah, sort of
the
mold.
Piece in the Times here kind of sticks with that going, you know, Liverpool, kind of he's gone to instance, but he's kind of always been supported. So perhaps he's gone, oh, I can get away with this. This is fine. For instance, like his incident with Patrice Evra, as soon as it happened, his manager at the time, Kenny Dalglish, comes down on his side.
He'll wear T-shirts. He'll wear T-shirts exactly. with his face on. It was outrageous. Yeah. It was a racist comment. He didn't shake his hand afterwards. Oh, yeah, we can add that to the litany, yeah. can't we? As well as the biting and the cheating. Well, the racism.
The point
well.
Is, when he sank his teeth into Giorgio Chiellini in the World Cup, he was not only supported by teammates and head coach, but the press and the president of his own country
the
said,
president.
FIFA is being mad. Why are they banning this? What's he done? He's done nothing wrong. And then Suarez recently came out and went, well, yeah, I bit him.
Yeah.
And you're like, what, hang on.
It's crazy, but it happens. I mean, you go back, and one of that riles me to this day, and when everybody brings it up, is Maradona. And yeah, and the film apparently is very, very
brilliant.
Good. Apparently
the
film is very, very good.
Brilliant.
But, you know, the thing that winds me up about Maradona, and he was an outstanding footballer, is for when he scored that first goal against England, to then say, the hand of God, that does it. And that is the thing that riles me more than anything else, that you can actually come up... And people say that's okay for him to say that.
Yeah.
And that is something that will that is one thing I will never ever get over.
Well, I wouldn't suggest watching the film, although I would suggest it because it's
I will watch the film. But
it will
yeah,
wind you up.
It
the
will.
Thing listen, these are type of players who divide opinion. If they're on your side, you love them. If you don't, if they're not on your side, you hate them. Can I just give you a little fact, by the way? Do you know Uruguay once had a president for that only lasted 20 minutes? Just by the
Did
way.
Did they shoot him?
So no, he was there and then suddenly he wasn't there. He was gone. So I'm just letting you know. I guess the Uruguayan president actually thought to himself, look, I better support Luis Suarez, otherwise I might be out of a job very, very quickly. These things can change. This is the Comedy Breakfast on Love Sport Radio. I'm a big fan of Suarez, by the way, in terms of the way he plays.
I think, I'd have him... People are just so instinctive and have got this desire and this hunger and this the way he plays, especially strikers. I applaud it all day.
And I watched Arsenal play Liverpool once at the Emirates, and this would have been about 6-7 seasons ago. Luis Suarez was playing for them. Right in front of us, we sat on the halfway line just behind the away dugout. Luis Suarez got the ball in his own half, played a pass with the outside of his right foot round the defenders. It was one of the best passes I've ever seen. Unfortunately for him, it was Jordan Henderson running onto it and he blasted it about 8 foot over the bar. But, and you could see Suarez's face as well, thinking, what am I doing playing with him? It was very funny, right? Fair play. Jordan Henderson's got a lot better, lifted the Champions League. But that Suarez pass just made us all... I mean, I wanted to give him a round of applause.
Yeah.
I didn't because it was Luis
Suarez.
Because
it was him, yeah.
Well,
and he was wearing the Oppo shirt.
Of course. Love Sports. The big debate this morning is about home pressure in major tournaments. This is on the back of England yesterday. Crumbling, really. Really, a batting collapse.
Yeah, to get beat like that against the Australians.
60-something runs, not good enough. And we're asking the question about whether playing a World Cup or a big tournament at home is almost too much now because of how you're under the magnifying glass. Now, you never played in a big tournament in England. But one can only imagine the pressure on stuff like this. But there's pressure all the time, isn't it?
There's pressure all the time. You know, it's sort of the nation expects, you know. And let's face it, we all have, because the way things have been built up for this England team going into this is you are the best in the world at this,
yeah,
at this format of the game, and you should go out there and win it. But my issue has been with the England team is when it comes to these games, these crunch, these games that, you know, would sort of sets you apart from the rest. We don't seem to be able to bring the ball. We don't seem to get it across the line. Whether our attitude is we'll go out there and play and give it a go, rather than go out there and we're going out there to destroy the opposition.
Destroy the opposition. Like the Steve Waugh Australian team did for 10 years,
yeah,
when they just crushed everyone.
Yes.
They're so competitive. But we were starting to look like we might have that
mentality.
We're getting
a bit of that, yeah.
But then suddenly...
Yeah, but it's a little bit what happened... You know, I mentioned earlier on what happened in the West Indies. They should never have got beat in the West Indies. They should never have got beat in the manner that they did in
that
the West
was bad,
Indies,
wasn't it?
And then
do you think that affected them a little bit? Because they came back from that and they beat Pakistan very easily.
Yes.
After that, didn't they? 5-0 in the series. So it's not like they looked like they'd recovered from that. That's
yes,
the point.
But they should not put themselves in that. It's almost as if we're taking two steps forward, then we end up taking this step back all the time. And rather than just keep pushing forward and keep pushing forward, that ultimately demoralises the opposition. Because when you walk out, quite often these games are decided when you walk out onto that cricket square, when you walk out onto the pitch. Because the opposition sees it in the eyes of the of where they're up against. They go, today we're really up against it today. And you've almost got yourself that. You've almost got that lead from then.
But we are talking specifically about home tournaments, and some of the examples we were chatting about in the break were France at the Euros, where they should have won in the football.
Yeah.
They should have won. They lost to Portugal in the final. And most famously, I think, Brazil.
Unbelievable.
In the World Cup.
Yeah.
The thing about Brazil in the World Cup, though, what was interesting to me is that they beat... who was it? Chile. I think they beat Chile. They might have played Panama, Colombia. That's right. Now, what I remember was the national anthem of Brazil playing and the whole team in tears. Hmm. And I remember remarking to my missus, and this is in a group game or in a first knockout game, they are never going to be able to maintain this because they're too emotionally invested.
Yes.
And that was partly because they were in Brazil. So when they come up against Germany, an efficient, excellent team who ended up winning the tournament...
Yep.
They got swatted aside because Germany were relaxed. Brazil were too keyed up.
They
too
were,
pumped.
You know, and all that. And I mentioned it again earlier about that energy, the emotion, how that drains the real energy and the power that you have in your body. It drains it out because you're investing that somewhere else rather than actually in the process of doing what you're there to do, is to play football.
Yeah, but then, okay, are we better off away from home? Actually, before I ask that question... That emotion can be used in a positive way. We've all seen Anfield on European nights.
That is the important thing about how you manage and how you use every day, every training session, every opportunity you get to create the right atmosphere, the right feel for all those players. So when they walk out onto that pitch, that is there to help them rather than hinder them.
You don't think England have been doing that in a cricket?
Yeah, but you're coming up against Australia. There's one game that almost you say, you don't need that today. Today, you're playing the Aussies today. And it should just almost put you into that place where you just walk into that pitch and do what you need to do.
So what happened? Why not then?
I have got no idea why they have not performed. You know, they weren't as sharp as we said in what they were doing. And they weren't, they never really took control of the game.
This is very interesting. Paris just put a question up on the screen, which I want to ask you, but I also can answer this as well, about being so pumped up you've lost focus.
Yeah.
Now, I know, and this goes for stand-up as well, by the way, before I'm going to go on, I'm ready to go on, I'm pacing about, and sometimes I'm not pumped up enough.
Yeah.
And I have to get myself going, right? Sometimes I can feel I'm a little bit excitable and I think I could say the wrong thing here.
Easily.
Just because it'll just pop out because I'm too excited.
Yeah.
Now, you must have had those feelings.
You do.
And you work on, and as you get more experienced doing what you do, you work on either getting yourself going or calming yourself down.
Yeah, the preparation that you go through, and it's a little bit, and it happens. I mean, golf is a great thing to explain. Yeah. In golf, if you played, regardless of what level you are, you've just had a great hole that you've just had. Oh, you just had a fantastic shot.
Your heart's going.
You know, and you're going, and you're like really putting, you're thinking, right, I'm going to go. And then you get to the next one, and you duff it here, there, and then you think, oh, and this the complete, golf is one of the best examples that I can give to people about how can that work. You can be at the very top, literally 30 seconds time, and in a couple of minutes time, you can be feeling the worst ever because of what you've just done. It's managing the expectation in yourself, managing the expectation of the people watching, you know, all of those people watching, whether at home or whatever, and keeping the focus, keeping your eye on where you're going and the how you're actually going to get there. And that it's almost this tunnel vision that you've got to get in the end of it. And all you can see, everything else is a blur apart from where you're going.
I mean, it does. I think this is interesting. It's slightly different to what we've been talking about, but I think it's interesting all the same. I've said this before. I remember watching Steve Davis play Joe Johnson in the World Final.
Yes.
And he crushed him. He beat him 18-5. And he played the last black. It went in, and he jumped back like he'd had an electric shock. And I asked him about it, and it was basically, he said it was like he came out of a trance.
Yes.
He was in a trance. He wouldn't have heard any of the crowd clapping or any of the cheers. Mm. He was just in the zone. England, in the cricket team in the past few years, have been in the main, in the one-day game, in the zone. Mm. I'm surprised at how quickly it's fallen away. The Pakistan result was, you could see little moments in there. The fielding was a bit slack. Sri Lanka was a very poor result, and I don't think they recovered from that when they were playing Australia yesterday. The last question before we end this big debate, how do they recover from this? How can they go? Do they go back to basics? What do they do?
They have to literally go back to basics. And the basics is, if we're batting, this is what we have to do when we're batting. You have to be more selective of when you attack and when you defend and whatever. That's what England need to do better at. They really have to do that. You cannot go out and expect to be smacking balls all over the place all the way through an innings.
You're talking about decision making.
Better decisions.
Make the right decisions.
But you've also got to execute it. Whatever decision you make, you have to then go and execute it in the correct way.
The one thing working in England's favour is that they're playing India this weekend in Edgbaston. Mm. It'll probably be more like an away game. It's very likely there'll be more Indian supporters in the crowd.
Yes.
It's very likely there'll be more Indian supporters in the crowd than there'll be England fans. It might actually suit England. Take the pressure off a little bit.
It could do. And
we hope.
Whatever they do, they just need to go out and have the exact right and just be decision-making better and execute the things that they need to do, and they will win the game. That is what it needs to be.
Which they've done
in the past.
Prior to coming into this tournament. Yeah.
This is Love Sport.
England's cricketers fell to a convincing 64-run defeat against Australia at Lord's yesterday, throwing their World Cup chances into major doubt. Owen Morgan was careful not to get too low after the loss.
Both this game and the last, we've struggled with the basics of what we call our batting mantra, you know, showing intent, building partnerships and doing it in our own way. And we haven't done those for long enough periods of the game.
Joining us now is a former England fast bowler and cricket correspondent for The Guardian, Mike Selvey. Good morning, Mike.
Morning.
Morning. Well, what's happened to us? I mean, we were going into this tournament as favourites, and now it's possible we'll go out before the semi-finals.
Yeah, I mean, I think the favourite tag was a bit premature, to be really honest with you. I saw some of the other sides much earlier on in the year, and I think they were pushing it a bit, say they were favourite. I understand why they said that, because they kept winning at home and it's in England. But I think there was that expectation. They were outplayed yesterday, weren't they? And in particular, you know, Owen's interesting there, because I think he's covering up for his bowlers, I reckon. Australia got a decent score, was my assessment of that. The pitches at Lord's this year have been really good pitches. They've given a bit to the bowlers, a bit to the bats. So there's always something in there for the bowlers. And I thought Australia, through a strange way of doing it, got to a competitive score, and that they had a really good bowling attack. We knew that. England didn't bat wonderfully well, but the key to that match was the bowling in the first 10-15 overs for England. When Australia didn't lose a wicket, they got away and they put 100 for the first wicket. And the game actually was really gone by then, I reckon.
Yeah, it did feel like we were never totally in it. I mean, Owen Morgan has said he's not panicking and he's not too cross with them. Do you think it is time to really shake things up a little bit?
I think they probably do that, don't they? You know, in their own minds, in the dressing room. Owen's a very phlegmatic character. He doesn't panic. We see that. You see it on the field. It's not an act. That's how he is. Years ago, I called him the Iceman when he was chasing targets down. That really is him. You know, I know him reasonably well, and that's it. That is his personality. He's a very strong person too. You know, he won't take any rubbish from them. Self-assessment's a really good thing in teams. You know, you have to point your fingers not at other people but at yourself and say, what can I do to make things better? And the bowlers yesterday, I thought, were pretty bad. In the first 10 overs, they bowled it's easy for people to say they bowled the long legs, pitch it up more. That's not a panacea either. It's got to be in the right place. But bowling on that particular pitch, at that particular ground, in those particular conditions, is a very specific thing. You don't have to do magic things with the ball. You just have to bang out a length, hammer out a length, a good length.
I've watched you do it.
Not back of a length.
I've watched you do it many times on that ground.
You're much older than I thought.
Yeah, no.
Wouldn't this have all been spoken about and they would have gone through this, though, leading into the game? And then you've got to ask, you know, why were the bowlers unable to do that?
I really can't speak for them. It's such a fundamental of playing the game there in those conditions. It really is. Now, some bowlers have a default of how they bowl. You know, if you said to Jimmy Anderson, you know, people are often saying to Jimmy Anderson, or people are saying, oh, Jimmy Anderson, why didn't he pitch it up more? Why doesn't he pitch it up more? And my answer to that is, well, I don't really want to tell a bloke who's got 600 test match wickets how to bowl. Jimmy's default is to bowl back of a length, just a hard length, not short, but hard length, so they can't get at him. And then he bowls a sucker ball. But Jimmy's sucker ball isn't a half volley. It's not out there. Jimmy's sucker ball is the length ball. And that is the ball that you need to bowl all the time in those conditions at Lord's at the start.
Yeah.
It's not back of... Now, England, you know, if you watch Chris Wokes banged it back of a length. These are not balls that are hitting the stumps, are they?
No.
And that's the proper length. It's not the same length that you need to bowl in all conditions. You know, let's be clear about that. It's just specific for yesterday's conditions.
And what about the batting, Mike? I know you're saying the bowling was where we lost it, but we were tentative against Sri Lanka. We were reckless yesterday. It doesn't feel like the thinking is very clear-headed.
I think you've got to be able to adapt, haven't you, to the circumstances. You know, you know, there's an element that says if you're chasing a low total, and 280 is a low total these days.
World Cup, though, Mike, is it?
Absolutely. But again, you have to look at the conditions. And you say, look, if you're chasing that kind of a total, you can get caught between two stools. You either say, well, OK, we don't need to rush this. We can just push it. Or you can say, well, let's just say that it's the sort of total that we, you know, forget the total almost. This is how we get our runs. This is how we will play the game. But they got off to a dreadful start. You know, James Vince plays, you know, got a very good ball, but didn't play it very well either. You know, there's two limits there. Joe Root got a very good ball. That's a standard. It's a brilliant delivery from a left arm over bowler to a right-handed batsman. That's a default dismissal, that, and it got a fine batsman out with a brilliant bowler. So you get those wickets. Owen suckered into doing what he did. So you're three down for a start, and it's
not
hard
great.
To claw it back then. That's when you have to either regroup or say, OK, let's take it to them. Ben Stokes played really well, didn't he?
Oh, Ben Stokes was excellent. But when he went, you sort of knew the game was up.
I mean,
they can recover from this. Of course. It's a lot of doom and gloom, but they probably win one game against India or New Zealand, which you would bet on them doing, winning one of them. And then they're probably in the semi-finals. And at that point, two games for the World Cup.
Well, yeah, you say they'll probably win one of those two. I mean, they left the three toughest games till last.
They did.
India were my favourites, pre-tournament favourites, to be honest. I saw India in New Zealand, beat New Zealand comfortably in New Zealand back in January. as I was out there, just happened to be out there. And I thought they looked an excellent side, India, for England conditions. They've got a really, really good bowling attack now for all conditions. So I thought they were... New Zealand, I'm astonished that anybody ever doesn't think New Zealand are a top side in these competitions. They're you each way bet every time, whatever. And they'll do it again. You know, if they win today, then New Zealand, I think that probably qualifies them, doesn't it?
I believe it does, yes.
Yeah. So they've got to play. They've got to play England last. You know, that might be England's, you know, World Cup final, if you want to call it that. Because if they don't win that, if they don't beat India and they don't win that, then they're sunk, and they deserve to be. If you can't win 5 games out of 9, then you're not going to go through, are you?
And one word about Australia before you go. Yeah. I mean, obviously, as a bowler, you must have enjoyed watching Jason Berendorf and Mitchell Starc yesterday.
They're excellent. You know, the ball to dismiss Ben Stokes is ball of the tournament for me.
Oh, it's a beaut, wasn't it?
That's high skill. Yeah. High skill. Yeah. No disgrace to getting out to that ball.
No.
And you know, they're fine bowl. Berendorf, I've not seen before. He bowled very nicely, didn't he? He had his day. I think they've got a really good bowling. The inclusion of Nathan Lyon's a good inclusion.
Yes.
You know, because you know he's a high quality bowler.
Yeah.
Suddenly they're creeping up Australia. They're over the, you know, it's only 6 months or so again. They're a shambles, aren't they?
Yeah. Tournament. And they love a World Cup though, don't they? Let's be fair.
Well, yeah. And they've built up to it, haven't they?
Yeah. Yeah. It's very, very impressive. Mike, hopefully we'll talk to you in better circumstances after the weekend.
Well, yes. When they qualified, how about that?
That would be very nice, Mike. Good to speak to you as always, Mike Selvey there, former England and Middlesex fast bowler and former cricket correspondent for The Guardian. I used to watch him. I used to go down and watch Middlesex quite regularly, and Mike Selvey steaming in. It was great to see him. Great to see him. And he's absolutely right about the length bowling, or lack of it.
This is Love Sport.
Kieran has come into the room because he's got stories from inside the newspapers. Good morning, Kieran.
Good morning, gents. How are we?
Yeah, we're all right. Thank you very much.
Good.
What have you got?
Well, what's the best presidential bird related pun you can come up with?
Bird related pun.
Yeah. Because the son have gone with
two. I was thinking, can I just try?
Yeah.
Something about bird in the hand is worth two in the George W. Bush.
Yeah.
That's not a bad one, is it?
That's not bad on the fly there.
Thank you very much. But you can come up with a better one.
It's Vladimir Putin.
Oh, I see what you've done. Oh, sorry. When you said presidential, I was thinking American. Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, it's quite
very
good, isn't it?
Very
that
nice.
Is very good.
Well, nice. Russia have unveiled a military drone.
Yeah.
But it looks like an owl. It literally, they've got like eyes on it and everything,
right.
And a big wingspan, but they're proper bird's wings going on. Created by a specialist unit set up by Vladimir Putin. So, it aims to fool the enemy and sneak close to targets.
Oh,
so it must be very small then.
So there's that
it looks quite like, yeah, I mean,
does it
sure.
make the noise? Does it do the tweet to woo?
It's only slightly bigger than a real snowy owl there, Lufa. So
that gives you an idea of scale. Yeah.
So it looks like an owl. So it's not like people will say, that owl has got weird propellers. Well, that's how, I didn't know owls flew by keeping propellers going.
But owls' wings move, and presumably the drone's wings, which are outstretched, don't move. So it's quite a big giveaway.
They must have had these discussions deep within the Kremlin.
They would have done, and then Putin would have gone, no, it's an owl.
Yeah, and they would have gone, you're right, Mr. President. The more I look at it, the more it looks like an owl. Okay, fair enough.
It locks lasers onto the target so they can then be destroyed by missiles, tanks and fighter jets.
Blimey, this is escalating quickly, isn't it? Suddenly from an owl flying about.
Yeah.
Suddenly, and by the way, is this owl flying about during, or this drone that looks like an owl, is it flying about during the day? Because that would be a bit of a
that
giveaway.
That would be a giveaway.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah.
That owl is up early. Whatever it is.
Snowy owl.
With the glowing eyes.
Yeah. You hear these stories, like, didn't they strap cameras to a whale or something?
To
a couple
whales,
they've
had a dolphin. They've got all sorts of things,
it's
haven't
awful,
they?
This stuff.
Seals. It's always been done, yeah.
It's not right.
No,
it,
it's
really?
Not right.
I don't like it. But anyway, what am I going to do? It's Vladimir Putin. He can do what he wants.
Yeah, essentially. I mean, you can't control what he does.
I can't, much as I try and, you know, exert some sort of controlling influence. Like, Vlad, what are you doing? Phone him up. Oh, Mr. Stowe. I've been waiting for you. Anyway, go on, what else you got? He's there stroking a cat before attaching a camera to it and sending it out. Go on, what have you got?
There's been some bad behaviour by teachers at Eton.
Has there?
Yeah, because a teacher at Eton College has been disciplined after throwing a whiteboard at one of his pupils class. Yeah, which are quite... I assume it's one of those show-me whiteboards, which are the ones that the pupils can write down something and then show the teacher. Because they're a bit more kind of portable, easily throwable as well.
I mean, I don't know, you could.
It's like a discus. You could get some action on that.
Hurt some with it. I mean, I've had board rubbers thrown at me. I've had a bin thrown at me once by a teacher. And I had another teacher who made me stand in a bin.
Did they?
In the corner of the class. Utterly humiliated.
Yeah, never had that. But no, I've never had any of that.
I've had stuff thrown at me. Yeah. I've had, no, this woman threw this, she taught, what did she teach? Hebrew, I think it was. She taught, she threw the board rubber at me. And honestly, I was watching a lot of cricket at the time and I thought, she has got a good throwing on her. I thought, if I'm ever playing cricket against her and she's fielding, I'm not risking a quick single. Because she really did. And the thing went swoosh, just past me head and then boof, into the back wall. And I thought, blooming heck, that's going to take me off.
It does get your attention, though, doesn't it?
It did. No doubt it did get my attention. Anyway, this teacher at Eton threw a whiteboard at a kid paying, or whose parents are paying, something like £30,000 a year.
Yeah, it's £12,900 a term.
Oh, 40 grand a year they're paying to go there.
Yeah.
Still, on the other hand, they'll probably end up in the cabinet. So, you know,
this is
swings
true.
And roundabouts. Yeah. Worth the...
Well, no one wants that job anyway. You've said yourself, no one wants a PM's job.
But you also might end up
You
might end up with a Telegraph column worth £275,000 a year. So, you know what? Then you can pay your parents back, can't you? At that point. Sorry, this sounds so cynical at this point. But you know what? But didn't you come in yesterday or the day before with a survey saying that, you know, people who go to Eton are much more likely to end up in the top jobs.
I did.
That's what goes on.
Yeah, so
they pay for it.
It was in a paper last week, I think, or the week before there was something about this.
Every
year.
Every year it's the same thing. So I guess they get their money back in the end. What else you got?
Loughborough Uni student Sam Rogers.
Yeah.
What do you think he's been doing? I mean, what time?
Loughborough Uni student.
He's got enough time, basically, to create the world's fastest jetpack.
Oh, good man.
Hits 50 miles an hour.
Oh,
that's quick.
Impressive. That's impressive.
Quick. I mean, I don't have a problem with him doing something like that because it's scientific advancement, isn't it?
Yeah, but I can't imagine. Well. Is it? Is jetpacks the future?
We're meant to have it years ago. I mean, at MIT, I think, in the 50s, these four students were messing about with rocket fuel and they almost blew up the dorm. But instead of that, they decided to get them to work on the jet propulsion lab. And that's how we ended up going to the moon. So out of these students having their own little side projects, things can change quite rapidly. And, you know, if we all come here by jetpacks next year...
Well, Mark Zuckerberg at college or something when he created Facebook at college, I think?
Yes, he was, indeed, yeah.
Well, you know, so it's,
wasn't it, according to the film, was it two other guys who created Facebook and he jumped in, according to the movie.
Yeah.
But, these things do happen and maybe this is a reasonable use of his time. I thought it was going to be worse than that, honestly, what he said. I thought it was going to be messing about with javelin and he killed a cleaner or something, but he didn't do that.
I mean, transport via jetpack would make London very interesting, wouldn't it?
What about your carbon footprint, though?
Well,
if everyone's fine about in one of them, can you imagine?
Do you know what? It's possible it would be worse.
Yes.
That's true.
Mm.
I don't know, but I'd love to have a go, though, wouldn't
you? Oh, it'd be great.
It'd be great. And if it's a choice between that and commuting, I know which one I'd like.
Yeah.
Okay, go on. What else? What else you got?
A simple urine test can.
Sorry.
Go
before
on.
We say that, Paris had just written there's a jetpack. Is a jetpack exempt from the ultra low emission zone? You're above it, aren't you? So possibly that's true. It's a good question, Paris. Thank you very much. Give us one more story before we.
Yeah,
go.
A simple urine test can reveal whether men have aggressive prostate cancer 5 years earlier than currently, and it could help thousands get life-saving treatment earlier because men are obviously typically terrible at going to their GPs and getting stuff checked out. But, you know, if it's a simple urine test, that could save many lives.
Yeah, yes. It would be very good because, I mean, I did some work with prostate cancer to promote and get more awareness. It started about 5 years ago. I started doing that with them, yeah. It is very, very important.
I think it's a really good idea. And it's not like, hey, men who are more prone to prostate cancer are men over 50, right? And well, I do know they wouldn't be short of a sample because I pee every hour on the hour, as far as I can tell, day and night. So, hey, like you missed out on that sample. You missed out on that sample, wait half an hour, I'll be going again.
Oh, but yeah.
Don't worry about it.
Well, I mean,
By the way, a mate of mine said to me once, he said, if you're at the football and you want to, and you have to queue up the urinals because there's loads of people, don't ever get behind someone who's wearing brogues because they could be there a while. You want a young guy wearing trainers. That's what you want. But it's a very good tip. Anyway, I think this is a great idea.
I definitely do. And this is scientists at the University of East Anglia. So, I mean, you know, people are having to pay thousands of pounds to go to uni, but they're doing some decent stuff when they're there.
Excellent, excellent. Very, very excited.
Love sport.
Thanks for listening to the Ian Stone Comedy Breakfast Podcast Edition. I'm back every weekday morning, 6:30.